Welcome to Discovering and Sharing Shuswap History.
Seymour Arm's Fruit Growing Era by Estelle Noakes. Seymour Arm came back to life in the early 1900s. Shortly after the turn of the century, the 1900s, the old town site and surrounding land were a burnt landscape following a forest fire. Surveyors mapping the area for the railway were the first to describe the remote end of the Seymour Arm as suitable for fruit growing. The soil of the valley was composed of sandy loam overlying clay, subsoil adjacent to the winding Seymour River. The sufficient rainfall eliminated the need for irrigation. This area was brought to the notice of Maxwell Smith, editor of The Fruit Magazine in Vancouver, British Columbia, who reported the following. I must admit to being agreeably surprised at finding a considerable area of land at the head of the arm suitable for agricultural purposes and particularly well adapted to the production of apples, pears, plums, and all kinds of small fruits. There is a diversity of soil at Seymour Arm, which makes it desirable for those engaged in fruit growing. That portion of the country at the head of Seymour Arm, which I had an opportunity of observing, seemed to be particularly well sheltered by the surrounding mountains, and for this reason, more tender fruits may be grown there than the latitude would indicate. The Seymour Arm Fruitlands Company, backed by British capital, was formed with a head office in Vancouver, British Columbia in 1908. The company acquired 7,000 acres north and northeast of the original 1865 Gold Town site. A 9x12 sheet of printed plan was the advertisement circulated in Canada, the USA, Britain, and the Scandinavian countries. It read, Seymour Arms, Fruitlands, Seymour Arm, British Columbia. Plan of portion of fruitlands. Total area of company property, 7,000 acres. Book to Sycamose Junction, CPRLY. Well, many new settlers arrived after purchasing their land sight unseen. The terms of the sale were 1/5 down with the balance in 4 annual payments. The company had subdivided the land into 5-acre lots, which sold for $125 per acre for fruit growing and $100 per acre for market gardening. The cost of establishing a 10-acre orchard, hiring out the labor, was stated as follows. Cost of clearing land at $1,750. Plowing and preparing at $60. 1,090 trees, including fillers, at $218. Planting, another $109. Cultivation for the first year at $170, which made a total outlay of $2,312. In April of 1910, Mr. Bert Freeman arrived to take up his post as manager of the Seymour Arm Fruitlands Company. By November of 1910, the company had provided a store, school, hotel, and a post office for the settlers' convenience. Oil lamps were installed at strategic corners and wooden water pipes were laid to the homes. Future plans were for power from Seymour Falls, bracket, this never materialized. The Fruitlands Company offered employment for less well-to-do settlers in building, clearing land, and fencing. The company owned the boat called the Distributor, which regularly provided service back and forth to Sycamose for passengers and supplies, and on its return took fruits and vegetables to the train for shipping. During the winter, the Maud Annis was hired to break the ice and to keep Seymour in contact with the outside world. The wharf, built in 1910 by Herbert Tansley, Cecil Dorr, and Maurice Gillis, was situated down in front of the hotel. Mr. Forrest Daniels built the hotel out of local cedar in 1910, and the Colling brothers painted it. Mr. Mogridge was the first manager of the hotel. And the first school It opened in the hotel in 1910, taught by Miss Cousins. There were 12 children of varying ages from the Daniels, Gilmore, Schauble, and Allison families. Miss Cousins died in 1914, the same year the first school building was opened with the next teacher, Mr. Alfred Hooper. Prosperity at Seymour Arm continued in 1911, with 50 new families expected and further delegations due to look over the land for future settlement groups. The population rose to 200, making Seymour the largest settlement on Shuswap Lake after Salmon Arm. The Fruitlands Company sold the hotel to a Mr. Bergen, who planned to completely remodel it. He was to add a billiard room and build a boathouse on the beach and provide facilities for boating and fishing in the hopes of making it an attractive tourist destination. However, the failure of a petition to procure a liquor license, the Seymour residents voted against it, for the hotel probably had an adverse effect on these ambitious plans. Nevertheless, in 1915, the hotel drew visitors from Kamloops and all over the Okanagan. It was in 1915, their first fall fair, that helped to boost the town's economy. People from all over the Shuswap came to see or bring exhibits of their own to display at the fair. There were 47 exhibitors on the wharf where everything took place. Transportation to the fair was assisted by excursions on the Maudanie from Blind Bay and on the Havana boat from Salmon Arm, offering a special rate of 50 cents for the round trip. Displays of garden produce and fruits were of excellent quality. Also displayed were baking, handiwork, flowers, and a category for best cleared and cultivated homestead. From Elbus, entries included the Jackson, Ford, Pedersen, Berg, Dolman, Endall, Finnegar, Godbout, and Stanley families. And from Seymour, the Daniels, Robillards, Smith, Collins, Schauble, Bass, Jenkins, Hislop, Gilman, Hulbert, Allison, and Hooper families also made entries. Entries from Blind Bay were from Mr. Bernard, and from Sorrento, Grease Hutchinson, and from Anglemont, Hudson's, and Holmes. A start was later made on a road contract to Sycamuse or Craigellachie, but the residents voted for a government-sponsored water link with Sycamuse instead. Throughout this period, the local roads had been improved, as well as a good trail made up of the West Fork of the Seymour River to the meadowlands below the mining venture on Grace Mountain. Mining became of an interest to the area when a group from Rossland purchased 8 claims for $200,000 on Grace Mountain in the year 1912. Their plan was to have a fleet of ore-carrying barges from Seymour to Sycamuse, and from there the ore could be shipped by rail to Trail for smelting. The mine, about 18 miles northeast of Seymour Arm, was named the Cotton Belt Mine because of the limestone dike running across it. A Negro worker likened the limestone dike to a cotton belt, and that is how it got its name. The ore contained high-grade lead, zinc, and silver. In 1917, the Cotton Belt Mine bought the hotel. Equipments and supplies were carried by pack horses to the mine, but that was soon found to be uneconomical because of the treacherous route and cost in time and money. Though 2 shafts were sunk and much ore piled on the surface, the only real ore to leave Grace Mountain were assay samples. It was just too difficult and expensive to transfer the ore, and it still is. The mine was abandoned. In 1914 and 1916, Seymour Arm was dealt several blows. The first calamity struck during World War I. The war had called settlers to the forces, leaving their families behind to face financial ruin. The second disaster was a severe black frost in 1916, which killed thousands of the fruit trees. The Seymour Arm Fruitlands Company was now short of funds. They had spent some $400,000 clearing land and developing, utilizing a mortgage from Dominion Trust in Vancouver. Dominion Trust, however, declared them bankrupt, and the corporation went into receivership. And of course, Seymour Arm went with it. Things after drifted along until finally the land reverted to the Crown for non-payment of taxes. Only a few families, including the Hislops and the Collings, had paid for their land and received the deeds for their properties, but the rest of the settlers were forced to leave to find work in nearby urban areas. A few settlers managed to stay, though, hanging on by logging, trapping, or growing vegetables and berries. Some made winter grub stakes by cutting firewood for the boats, bringing $1.50 a cord when piled along the lake. Some found employment doing exploratory work at the Cotton Belt mine site. The Colling brothers operated a cannery for small fruits until the cost of freight and labor no longer made it profitable. And in 1925, the hotel was closed. Logging was the mainstay after the collapse of the Fruitlands venture. A logging and sawmill settlement was still viable at Albus, 4 miles to the south, with a population then of 150 residents. But once again, the difficulty and cost of transportation of the finished product caused the industry to fail. Around Seymour, logging went well, with booms of 2 million board feet being towed to the mills by the steamers and tugs. For a while, two donkey engines dragged the timber from the valley slopes to the Seymour River, which then floated it to the lake. But once this easily accessible supply of timber was exhausted, it proved impossible to haul logs to the lake from sources further afield on the very wet, poor roads of the day. Mail and merchandise, though, continued to be delivered to the remaining settlers and homesteaders at Seymour as part of the subsidized freight and mail system. The Shuswap Transportation Company had the contract for delivery and supply to Seymour, but the old icebreaker, the Maud Annie, was condemned, and the company had to find a way to deliver to Seymour in winter. They tried a gas boat, but it got caught in the ice. And then the next trip was up on skates, but they could not deliver freight by this route, so the company decided to try their luck with an old Ford truck, and were quite successful. The truck could pull 3 loaded sleighs, and service was supplied with no interruption to Seymour Arm. In the winter of 1929, there is a note in the Salmon Arm Observer that the first motorized vehicle had arrived in Seymour. From 1929 on, with the fall of the stock markets in North America and the ensuing depression, more residents left Seymour, and by 1940, the settlement was almost deserted except for the Daniels, Collings, and a few other settler families. Through the ensuing years, many descendants of the early pioneers returned to Seymour Arm, as well as new residents. The solitude and the challenge of the wilderness setting still call out to some who have tired of the hectic life.
In the early 1970s, my father, Ray Clement, was the town locksmith. He also had his blasting certificate, thanks to being an engineer during the Second World War. One day when I came home from school, my dad announced that he was going to be in the newspaper. It seems the previous night, two thieves had broken into Askew's Foods downtown to break into the safe. However, Lloyd Askew's boys had discovered them and apparently whacked at least one of them with a hockey stick, then called the RCMP. As it turned out, not only was one of the men on the Canadian Top 10 Most Wanted list, he was in possession of 4 ounces of nitroglycerin. The RCMP must have been familiar with Dad's history because they called him in to neutralize the nitro. The explosive was homemade, so Dad needed to know the fellow's recipe. He walked into the cell to see this fellow, head all bandaged, muttering, "I don't know why they hit me. I don't know why they hit me. I'm not a violent man." I got the particulars from him. Stepping back out into the station, Dad was horrified to see one of the officers casually tossing the bottle of explosive liquid into the air and catching it, not realizing that it was still very much active. I don't know much about nitroglycerin, but after seeing a couple of demonstrations of just a few drops on YouTube, had the bottle hit the ground, it would at least have taken out the police station. Quickly convincing the officer to set the bottle down, they took a trip to the dump, and Dad neutralized the nitroglycerin. And yes, he was in the paper the following week, very briefly.
This is the story of the Codds and the Walters of Notch Hill by Estelle Noakes. Notch Hill is a small detour off the Trans-Canada Highway at Sorrento or Balmoral. At one time, the highway went through Notch Hill, and it was a thriving center for freight, timber mills, and farming. The town of Notch Hill was built in 1910 on land donated by adjacent farmers. It was named for a notch between the mountains where the CPR, the Canadian Pacific Railway, laid its tracks in 1885. For many years, it was a CPR town with a train station, a packing house, freight shed, oil tank, water tank, coal chute, sand house, pump house, and a roundhouse. Notch Hill was a center for the surrounding areas. The railroad brought shipments from all points and dropped them at Notch Hill, where they were transported first by wagon and then by truck to other areas and to the ferry or barges for shipment around the Shuswap Lake. Besides being a CPR train center, the village had three stores, a school, a hall for the community, a garage, a jail even, post office, and two churches. There were over 600 people living at Notch Hill by the 1920s. Although there are many changes, today the scenic drive through Notch Hill retains its rustic charm with its historic buildings, old barns, and fertile farmland. Many of today's residents are descendants of early settlers still living on the old family farms. Some of the historic town buildings have been restored. On the Hall property, the Heritage School built in 1921 has been restored. The Presbyterian Church built in 1906 and moved to its current location in 2004 is again in use, and the community hall that was built in 1910 has also been restored. Even the old graveyard has had a refurbishing with new gravestones and cataloging. There is even an inviting picnic area under ancient old maples. John Henry Codd and family. Henry Codd was born in 1893 in Wales. He was one of 10 children. His family had had a long history as horse contractors raising purebred Percherons. They were also sheep and dairy farmers and operated a grist mill. Henry immigrated from Wales at the age of 17, settling at Minburn, Alberta. He fought in World War I, though, and was injured and returned to Canada. Henry was well known in Alberta as a purebred Percheron horse breeder, as well as a successful cattle rancher. Keith Walters says his uncle was a tough man. In Wales, he barehand boxed with the gypsies, riding 35 miles each way to do so. He was also known as a high-stakes poker player, and he even made moonshine in Alberta, both of which he gave up on when he moved to BC. Beside his sister, Rosalind, and her three children, Henry brought from Alberta a carload of cattle, 22 purebred Percheron horses, and an Englishman named Harry Massey, who worked for them. They arrived in Notch Hill in March of 1935 to find 4 feet of snow. Henry had purchased a property from the George Gurr family. It was the original homestead of the Martin Johnson family. There was an old livable house on the property, which the family used until building a new one in 1936. The new home was built with first-grade lumber. It had a basement, and it cost a total of $2,000 to construct. When Henry gave the contractor a $200 bonus, the man broke out in tears. That was a lot of money in those days. Eventually, the farm had chicken, pigs, cattle, and horses, as well as a very large family garden. Henry was known to be a kind man and gave much to his community. He loved horses and treated them with great care. He believed also in treating people well and often paid his workers double the going wage. For over 40 years, Henry served as chair of the Notch Hill Community Association. He also served 10 years as a school trustee and 10 years as chair of the Farmers Institute. Overall, he had 50 years as a trustee of the Cardinal Estates, and for many years he worked with the Chase Fall Fair. In 1984, Henry died at the age of 91 and is buried in the Notch Hill Graveyard. Frances Elizabeth Roslyn Codd Walter, sometimes known as Walters. Known as Rosalind, she was born in 1910. She had immigrated to Canada in 1927 at the age of 17, along with her brother, Ed Codd. Later, another brother, George, relocated to Canada. In Alberta, Rosalind married Paul Walter and had three children, Keith, Gwyn, and Yvonne. Rosalind separated from her husband in 1935 and, along with the three children, accompanied her brother Henry to Notch Hill. There she looked after the home and the children. In 1942, Henry Codd set aside a small property for Rosalind and her new partner, Henry Blackman. Henry Blackman was a farmer and a logger. Henry and Rosalind built a home on the property where they lived with their two younger children. Keith, though, stayed with his uncle Henry. Henry Blackman died in 2000 at the age of 94. He is buried in the Eagle Bay Cemetery. In her later years, Rosalind left and lived with her daughter Yvonne. In 2006, she died at the age of 96. At some time, Rosalind changed her name from Walter to Walters. Keith and Anita Walters. Keith and Anita are people who would be referred to as the salt of the earth, or pillars of the community. But they are much more, dedicated to their family, friends, and their community. They have resided on the same farm in Notch Hill almost all their lives. Keith from the age of 6, and Anita at the age of 21, from the time of her marriage to Keith. They still enjoy life on the farm at Notch Hill, surrounded by good memories, good friends, and their large family. Keith remembers the Notch Hill area in the early 1900s as being inhabited mostly by Swedes, Norwegians, and Finns. Keith has a wonderful memory and can reminisce all day about the old-timers and the history of this unique area. For the listener, it is a nostalgic trip down memory lane. Keith Walters had been born June 30, 1930, in Viking, Alberta, on his family farm. He was 5 when his mother and father separated. He remembers arriving at Notch Hill. At the station that day, men came to help them unload, and amongst them was John Lindsay, who became a lifetime friend. John passed away in 2011. Keith recalls his uncle shipping the purebred horses and cattle by train from their Notch Hill station. The Indian school in Kamloops were a regular customer for the horses as they wanted to improve their stock. Keith has kept up the tradition of raising purebred Percherons, and his son Irwin is following in his footsteps. Keith also has riding horses and says he's never been without a good horse. At the age of 7, Keith began going to school in Notch Hill, where he finished grade 1 and 2. Just after that, he suffered a ruptured appendix and gangrene set in, so that over the next 5 years, Keith was in hospital almost continuously, where he underwent 4 to 5 operations, as he remembers it. From a fellow patient, the family heard about an army doctor, Dr. Wallace, who was returning to the area and who had had a good reputation with abdominal surgery. Keith was taken to Kamloops, where Dr. Wallace had set up his practice. There, Dr. Wallace operated, and Keith recovered quickly afterwards and says he's never, ever looked back. After missing so much school, Keith was too old to go back to school, so he said. At the age of 14, his uncle, Henry Codd, gave him an 80-acre farm across the road from where the family lived. There, Keith built a cabin and some barns. In the next years, he cut firewood at $3 a cord with a crosscut saw and delivered it by horse and wagon. He supplied the Notch Hill Hall with firewood for many, many years. In addition, he did horse logging for other people, including Ed Riley at Celesta. Keith says he was skidding with horses by the time he was 16. One of his first logging jobs was for Saul Rabbi, where he worked a 10-hour day for a whole $5 bill. Later on, he bought the Rabbi's 80 acres for $400. Keith also raised horses and cattle, farming with his Uncle Henry Codd for over 50 years. At one point, though, Keith worked in Prince George for 5 years for the Forest Service as a foreman of the bush crews, but was always happy to return home and go back to farming. In 1948, Keith remembers buying a new rubber-tired wagon and a nice new team of horses. He headed to the Caribou with a friend, Cecil Milliken, for 8 days and worked all year cowboying and haying for two old bachelors, the Scallons, who had originally been heading for the gold fields and had decided instead to ranch. In 2010, Keith, along with sons Reg and Dewey and grandson Rylan, decided to retrace that route. They also went to the Gang Ranch and into the Empire Valley and to Red Mountain, where they have a cabin. When he was much younger, Keith played badminton. And in winter, there was a skiing hill on the mountain across from the farm that had ski jumps and everything. A Finnish resident, Mr. Fenn, made excellent skis for $4. Keith says he would tie a rope to the saddle horn and his horse would pull him up. After skiing all day, the horse was really ready to come home, and he says he had some pretty hair-raising trips getting back home. He also remembers being able to sleigh in toboggan right down to the Sorrento Wharf. His favorite getaway was to ride up Black Mountain to the Seldom Inn, a cabin named by Joe Eady and built by Keith and the Mowers. Unfortunately, the cabin burned in the Notch Hill fire. In 1957, Keith met Anita Blackman when she had come to the area to attend the wedding of her sister, Yvonne, who was marrying Chris Dallin. Anita had attended high school in Kelowna and was still living there, working at the Kelowna Courier. She was the niece of Henry Blackman, who was Keith's mother's partner. Anita was born in 1938 to pioneers of the Valemont area, Bill and Ellis Blackman. Bill had been a trapper, a logger, and a big game guide. Anita has 3 brothers. In the beginning, Anita and Keith had a long-distance courtship. Anita tells a story once of Keith, along with a buddy, visiting a gambling place before coming to see her. Of course, the two were broke when they showed up, and she had to lend them $10 to go home. Nevertheless, Anita and Keith married in her family's log home in Valemont in 1959. Anita says they had no money and no vehicle, so they traveled back to Kamloops by train, where Henry Codd picked them up in his 1949 truck, which is today still on the farm. Keith had built them a little home, which Anita found quite delightful. It even had a new chrome table and chairs, hot water heater, and a fairly new bedroom and living furniture. It also had canned peaches and pears from his mother that were stored in the cupboards, a freezer full of meat, and lots of wood. That fall, they managed the luxury of buying their first truck of their own. The Notch Hill fire in 1973? Well, Anita has clear memories of that. Keith would come home from his graveyard shift at the mill, pack a lunch and work all day, come home and sleep a few hours, and then go back to his job. He did that all summer. After leaving Holdings, Keith worked for the forestry for a few years up on the Fly Hills, White Lake, and Eagle Bay area. He would camp up in the high country, and his job was to move the cattle around so they didn't overforage in the newly planted areas. His only company was his border collie, who was a most willing helper. Keith worked for various other people, including some on the North Shore, Ed Riley and Pat Bischoff, to name two. He also was known to help with haying on North Shore farms, including George Lamberton and Prince Orser's place. The Walters eventually raised four sons on the farm. Reginald, born in 1959, Gerald, nicknamed Dewey, born in 1960, Irwin, born in 1962, and Ian, born in 1964. Henry Codd was a great sportsman and those boys' greatest coach. All four excelled at hockey and baseball. Keith says he's been in every arena and ball field in the country. He would put on almost 80,000 kilometers a year to do so. And at that time, he could buy a Dodge Dart and trade it in every 3 years and just pay $1,300 to get the next newest car. During this time, Key says he didn't save a nickel. It all went to the kids. Dewey went on to a world competition in baseball, and Ian spent 3 years playing for the Kootenai Hockey League. It was actually due to the sports schedule of his sons and the cost to attend that Keith eventually gave up milking cows and got a job at the Adams Lake Lumber Company, also in those days known as Holdings Mill. There he worked for 20 years, night shift on the boom, from 1970 to 1990. And for some of those years, Anita's cousin, Bill Blackman, lived with them on the farm. They looked after him, and he helped them around the farm. Anita is known locally as an exceptional artist. Using pastels, she has created scenes of the area and the old buildings around Notch Hill. In addition, she is quite adept at quilting. Keith judged logging shows for many years throughout the valley, while Anita was competing with Sandy Mowers in the Jack and Jill crosscut event, winning many awards. Keith also was known to judge the heavy horse pull events at local fairs and at the PNE. In the 1980s, when a train car overturned a load of grain on the Walters' land, it provided a great opportunity to purchase some chickens and use up all that feed. The cabin that became the chicken house was the very first one that Keith had built on the property. Today, they still keep chickens, but now just for their own use. Keith and his sons, along with his lifetime friend Sandy Mowers, took numerous horse hunting trips in the Yalacombe River country, north of Lillooet, where they have a prospector's cabin. Keith also enjoyed trips with his cousin Julian Codd, the son of Ed Codd, who was farming at Tappan. In 1991, Keith, along with his son Irwin, rode in the first Kamloops cattle drive. Keith and Sandy Mowers spent many winters top-loading Christmas trees for shipment to Vancouver, and the Walters sons continued this business until last year. It's been for over 20 years that the Walters have given horse and sleigh rides, known as the Broderick Creek Sleigh Rides, pulled by their purebred Percherons. That enterprise actually began as a treat for their friends. The rides are a true delight and a trip down memory lane for any of the lucky sleigh riders. Riders are bundled up in Anita's and her mother's homemade quilts and given cinnamon buns and hot chocolate at the end. Their son Irwin does most of the rides these days. In 1998, Keith visited his Welsh homeland with his sons Ian and Reg. The Walters have many relatives still living there. Keith made a point of visiting the gypsy camps that his uncle Henry Codd spoke so often about. Keith says it was too rainy for him and he would never want to live in Wales for very long. His Welsh relatives, though, are sixth-generation farmers of horses, sheep, and dairy. Keith and Anita have been and still are staunch supporters of their community. They are both lifetime members of the Notch Hill Town Hall and instrumental in the restoration of the historical buildings, including the care of the Notch Hill Cemetery, most recently aided by Louise Barber. For 9 years, Keith was a director with Caravan Farm Theatre during the theater's touring days. The caravan would stop at the Walters Farm and put on their performance during their tours, which was a delight for the whole community. Anita still keeps busy with the Notch Hill Community Association, which has done an admirable job of keeping up the archives and restoring the old buildings. The Wolters property, itself a veritable museum with four old log buildings, which have been dismantled and restored. One is a blacksmith shop, and one of their log buildings was a demonstration building built by Sandy Mowers with logs salvaged from the Notch Hill Fire of 1973. Its purpose was to teach the Walters' son to build. It is now a cozy cabin used for the Broderick Creek bed and breakfast as a guest house. The Walters' sons have also been instrumental in helping restore historic buildings. The Walters' sons live quite close by. Keith has been able to return the favor once granted him by Henry Codd and has given each of his sons a fair parcel of land. The Walters today have six grandchildren and three step-grandchildren. Keith's brother, Gwyn, worked for BC Hydro and lived in various places around British Columbia. It was in 2002, though, that he passed away. Yvonne is living in Louis Creek. And Harry Massey, who came from Alberta with Henry Codd, had died in 1938, and he's buried at the Notch Hill Cemetery. Paul Walter died in 1973. Keith actually ended up meeting a stepbrother, Neil, in 1973, and discovered his father had been living at Medicine Hat, Alberta. Keith visited his father for the first time since his parents' separation when he was just 5 years old. Paul Walters died shortly after that visit and is buried at Medicine Hat.
For more information on these and other stories, please contact the Salmon Arm Museum at Haney Heritage Park or visit us when we are open during the summer season.
Yip Fat Chong and his cousin Yip King came to Salmon Arm in 1930 to run their hotel on Hudson Street. Rolly Jameson tells of the events leading up to a particular Christmas Eve in 1933 at the hotel. When Captain Louis maneuvered his paddle wheeler, the C.R. Lamb, into the Salmon Arm Bay with his last delivery of the year, Chong and King were in for a surprise. Along with his delivery came the big and powerful logger, Ole Anderson from Seymour Arm. Anderson went directly to the Canada Hotel, where he registered, for a room. The Yip cousins looked intently at each other and exchanged a few choice words in Chinese. The logger had been a guest before. A few days later, Bill Quinn, followed by his brother Art from Grand Prairie, also checked in. Anticipating a brawl, the cousins moved the player piano out of the lobby. Then Yip Chong carried on as usual. He did his Christmas deliveries, a free turkey and a box of Chinese ginger to the positioned people in the community, the mayor, city clerk, and chief of police. Meanwhile, Ole Anderson was preparing his own Christmas celebrations. He confiscated a large pot from the kitchen and obtained cider from Sims' factory across the tracks, and threw in some rum, oranges, and raisins for flavor. All who drank were expected to add alcohol to the mixture, whipping up a special brew. The fumes alone were intoxicating. Having imbibed in more than their share of spiked cider, the Quinn brothers began quarreling over the widow from Tappan. Both were sure they had her favor, and there were discussions of another kind happening in the kitchen. Rolly Jameson, Jim Brewster, and a large group of non-drinking, apple-pie-eating locals had gathered to solve the world's problems. With liquor and solutions flowing, it didn't take long for Rolly and Jim to realize there was trouble brewing. The cousins would need help before the night was out. The Quinn brothers were standing at the foot of the stairs opposite the front door when in walked Ole Anderson and the widow from Tappan. The sound of splintering wood, angry shouts and screams from the widow bolted our young heroes from the kitchen. The woman's voice screaming, "Those crazy men are killing each other!" galvanized forces. Yip King ran to his bedroom and locked the door. Yip Chong cried quietly as he continued to cook a meal for a patron. Their fears were becoming a reality. Jim and Rolly rushed to the lobby, pushing the battling trio through the broken door and out onto the porch. The fight carried on. Rolly seemed to be winning, swinging at the brothers alternately, until the brothers realized they had an enemy in common. The fight moved to the street. Jim and Rolly returned to the kitchen. Everything was going to be okay. They placed the shattered door in its hole, and with a splintered board nailed across for fortification, they locked down the hotel. The hotel was quiet. Men snored happily on the floor in the lobby, and the widow left, vowing to stay away from drinking lagers at Christmas time. Eventually, the Yips sold their hotel and opened the BC Coffee Shop. The clientele was quiet and the hours regular. Apple pie was on the menu again, but they didn't serve drunken lagers. When Yip King retired to Calgary, Yip Chong stayed on to take care of business. One morning in 1956, Chong failed to put the coffee on. His cooking days were over. When a friend found him in bed, Bauer's funeral service was called in. The mayor was one of the 6 pallbearers, and his friends erected a headstone.
My name is Dorothy Rolin. I'm the current president of the Salmon Arm branch of the Okanagan Historical Society. If you have stories or memories you'd like to share with this program, please call Voice of the Shuswap at 250-463-5026 or email info@voiceofthesuswap.ca. Discovering and sharing Shuswap history.
This radio program was made possible by a Government of Canada New Horizons grant, helping celebrate Canada's 150th anniversary.